I just want to say a few things from last class. People contacted me. Stanley pointed out that his friend Sam Kapustin, who I gather is from Toronto, whose father studied at the Berlin Seminary, told me that when Rev Weinberg attended the opera, a group of students would meet him to make up a Myriv minion. That goes back to what we spoke about, where I said I didn't know if he had an appreciation for music or not. I will tell you that this Kapustin, there's a tshuva from Rev Weinberg to him. I mentioned last time also this proposed constitution from Rev Herzog. The English title of it is A Constitution and Law in a Jewish State According to the Halakha. Here's a copy of it. I should point out that he wasn't the only one doing this. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who we're not going to deal with, but one of the most interesting figures, Rabbanim, early 20th century, in his Malki Bakodesh, talks all about these same issues, how to have a parliament, the role of democracy, etc. And also a rabbi by the name of, well, let me tell you that in 1950 a book appeared called Chukat Olam. You can see it here with an English title page. The Eternal Law, a Proposed Constitution for the State of Israel, According to the Biblical and Talmudic Interpretations and Opinions. You see that how Zionistic it is. You can see the, Declaration of Independence of Israel and the sign. This was written by a Rabbi Tibor Stern. At the time, he was a young Rav in Kansas City, later becomes moves to Miami, becomes Big Tam Chacham, best known as the Rav HaMashkiach, Rav HaMachshir, for Hebrew National. And at the end of his life, he was also co-chairman with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik of Agudas HaRabbanim. But he also wrote a proposed constitution for the State of Israel. You know, in those days, they thought every building would have a mezuzah on it. One other thing on the opera, I found this week, just coincidentally, that Rav Israel Hildesheimer's daughter has a memoir, and she reports that her father used to sing opera to them after Shabbos lunch. A couple of other things relating to what Yisrael asked me at the end. Well, first I mentioned this great story from Rav Greenblatt, and I think I said that he was in the Stern group, Lechi. Actually, he was in the Irgun, not Lechi. And I said Chevron. I'm not sure if it was Chevron at that time. But the fundamental question Yisrael asked was about extremism, violence. And let me tell you two things, interesting things. I teach this course at Yeshivas Chovevei Torah on religious denominations, and I tell the students something which they're shocked to hear, and no one knows about it. It's a story of how in Lemberg, Lvov, the Reform rabbi was murdered by an Orthodox person because of his beliefs, and it became a huge controversy. The Rav was put on trial. And like I said, this is totally unknown, but maybe not, because about 3 weeks ago this book came out, A Murder in Lemberg, by Michael Stanislavski of Columbia University, a small little book in which he deals with the murder of the Reform rabbi. But the fundamental question is that I call your attention to a book, a famous article by Charles Liebman, Extremism as a Religious Norm. That religion, by its nature, has a habit of moving into extremism, especially when it's not involved in general communities, when it's of a sectarian nature. And it also often leads to violence. I mean, we obviously see this in the Islamic world. We've seen it in Christian history. It could be Yigal Amir. It could be Haredi hooligans on the bus beating up women who don't go to the women's section, the Satmar who fight each other. In fact, I get a newspaper. They can't sell this on the street. It's a National Enquirer of the Haredim. It's called Panim Chadashot. And the front story is about the Ger Chasana, Chasana B'Tzel Machokas. And then you have the Satmar Rebbe attacking the Ger Rebbe for putting something in English and in his newspaper and on the inside. It's about the Vizhnitz fights. And then you have an article here, Chasidei Satmar. Well, I'll read it to you. Chasidei Satmar, Hiku Chasidei Papa, Shetiltelu B'Shabbos. Now, some Satmar attacked some Papa Chasidim who are carrying in the Erev in Williamsburg on Shabbos. And if you know what goes on, they cut the Erev down. And it's part of the nature of extremism. In Kiryas Yoel, it's been a common thing. I'll get to the questions in a second. In Kiryas Yoel, they would vandalize each other's houses and cars. It goes on in Babov. It goes on in Ponevez with the bomb and with the beatings. sometimes modern Orthodox people have an idyllic conception of life in B'nai Brak, places like that, but the fact remains that there is huge machlokas, much more there than in the modern Orthodox world. It's a constant feature. So the question is, why? And I have a theory, which I've never seen anyone state, but I think it's correct, that in Israel, they have, especially in Israel, there's such a problem with what they regard as the wild people. And I understand the Gedolim maybe can't control them. They always say that they don't support this. But you do have these hooligans. And my answer is as follows, that in Haredi society in Israel, there's no entertainment. There's no cultural activities. There's no public libraries. There's no sports, either watching or participating. There's no barbecues. There's no family get-togethers with other families. There's no Saturday activities. There's no pizza shops. There's no restaurants. There's no movies. There's no television. The list goes on. I think many people find this environment stifling, and therefore machlokes, fights, it's almost like a form of entertainment, a form of letting off steam, of breaking out of the confines of an environment like that. Now, the pointed out, I agree, the moderates in Islam. I want to say it's Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is if it's not known. This is Davar Yadua. Okay, let's pick up with the Herzog. We ended last class talking about how Rav Herzog recognized that the science in the Talmud and the fact that we now have different science was going to have a change, affect a change in halacha. One is that it says in the Gemara that a woman who marries after 20 will not be able to have children after 40. And there were Dayanim who were taking this as fact. For example, according to the halacha, if you're married 10 years and the woman didn't have children, you can demand a divorce. And you had cases in Israel where people got married, let's say the woman was 33, and at 40 they would have been married 7 years and they demanded a get. And you had Dayanim that said, well, look, she hasn't had children. She got married after 20. She's not going to have any children. And they were compelling Gittin. Now, obviously, this isn't something that anyone with a knowledge of modern biology could take seriously. And Rav Herzog, therefore, rejects it. And this is not so significant, except for that while in his scholarly essays, he speaks about how the rabbi's knowledge of science was based upon the Greeks. In this tshuva, he doesn't say that. He simply says nature has changed. Whereas it used to be that maybe when they married at 20, after 20, they wouldn't have children after 40. Today, nature has changed. Now, it's hard to know whether this is just an expression or is meant seriously. For example, Rav Tendler's claims that when Rav Moshe Feinstein used the expression nature has changed, it's just a polite way of saying that the sages of the Talmud were relying on science and this science was mistaken. Another example, the Talmud states that the man, woman, and God are partners in man, and that the blood comes from women. That's what it says, and I don't know if there's any reason to see this anything other than an agotic statement. And yet there were poskim, such as Rav Uziel and Rav Unterman, who took this very seriously, who thought that this was stating a question of fact. And therefore, you have a real problem, because before DNA, which I know Rabbi Jasper spoke about, you determined paternity, or at least you determined if someone was not a father, based on blood tests. And Rav Uziel and Rav Unterman ruled, based upon this, that blood tests are no good. If a man is married and there's a child, he can't claim the child's not his and then have a paternity test done, because we don't trust paternity tests, because the blood does not come from the father. It comes from the mother. The Tzitz Eliezer even held this position, believe it or not. Now, the Tzitz Eliezer, no question about it, was a great posek, especially in medical. But in medical issues, I have to say that he really had no knowledge of medicine. And yet he became the great post-take in medical issues because he was the post-take for Shaare Tzedek Hospital. But it's not surprising that Rav Tendler speaks contemptuously of a number of his tshuvos when it comes to medicine. For example, on this very issue, the Tzitz Eliezer writes how your blood type could change over the years, that's why we can't rely on blood, or that if you get a transfusion, not that it might kill you, but it could change your blood type. And it's embarrassing, I think, to read these things, and shows why Rav Tendler was so contemptuous, and why modern Orthodox people certainly would have a problem with this. And people often think of the Tzitz Eliezer as a modern Orthodox posek of sorts, and the Yeshiva Schob Vetorah had a whole thing a few months ago in his memory. He passed away just a few months ago. And that's because they point to his very liberal view on abortion. So they think that he's some liberal posek. Fact is that many poskim are liberal on abortion, and if you want to know how illiberal he is, just look at what he says about reform and conservative. He says one place, rather go, it's better to go into, if I'm not mistaken, go into the house of idolatry than go into the reformed temples, because those are houses of heretics. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, a great posek who died recently. In fact, I'll give you another example that Rav Temer goes crazy about. Rav Waldenberg claims that if a man has a sex operation, then he doesn't have to give his wife a get. It's like Elijah. The story that there was a number of chakiros. If Elijah went up to heaven, does his wife need a get? And they decide that she's not married anymore because he's assumed a new status. So instead of a man with a sex change operation, instead of seeing this as a man who just needs help, who deformed himself, mutilated himself, Rav Waldenberg saw this as like a new creation. And then understand what this means, that if the wife gets married, this is adultery, and the children are miserim. But so it's a bit of a problem. By the way, along these lines, I picked up a very interesting sefer. I'm sure some of you are aware that there's been an explosion of publication in Jewish law. Print is cheap. You don't need the Bacher Zetzer, as they used to call it. It's all done by computer. And every topic under the sun has a book of halacha devoted to it. Things that are in the Shulchan Aruch constitute one line have complete books. And I'm going to show it to you because you wouldn't believe it otherwise. This came out, a Haredi book last year. It's called Dor Tapuchot, and it's all, look how thick it is, all the halachas of people who've had sex changes. Everything from counting them in a minyan to gittin, it's quite incredible, but they're running out of topics, I guess. But it is worth noting, and I said I'll mention Rabbi Jachter, because the modern Orthodox have really ceded the area of halacha. Emanuel Rachman, in an article in Judaism in the 1960s, reviewing Negros Moshe, said that the modern Orthodox don't need to write on halacha because they have Rav Moshe. But you can count on one hand all the books dealing with practical halacha written by modern Orthodox. The first, one of the first is Rabbi Dayan Grunfeld, The Jewish Dietary Laws. Rabbi Jachter is one of the few. I only count five on my hand. There's this book just came out by Dina Zimmerman on Nida, although based upon the two reviews I've seen, this is not a modern Orthodox book. This book is more strict than the Haredim, whether it's because she feels that she's a woman, she can't make decisions. The Haredim tell you in their books, the woman makes decisions. In Dina Zimmerman's book, she tells you everything, Esther of. So the two reviewers, Aviad Stolman and Moshe Benevitz, point out, what's the point of putting out a book if all you're going to do is tell people Esther Rabbi? You don't need a book then. So that is not a modern Orthodox book. Michael Breuer has not written for practical halacha. He's just an academic serious study. I'm talking about for people who live. And the last one, I'll just tell you, Yudankin also, maybe Yudankin, but they're more of essays. Not this book, I don't know if any of you know this, called The Secret of the Jew. When the history of modern Orthodoxy in America was written, this will have to be dealt with. It was published, here's a picture of the rabbi. His name is David Miller, he came from Slobodka, he was a Rav, he went to Oakland, where he became quite wealthy, and he published this book in this how thick it is. It's all about the laws of Nida, and it's more than that, though. It was distributed free all over America. That's why you can get many copies of it on internet sites, but you have to make sure you have this copy, because the whole point of the book was to teach everyone. In those days, remember, many women, even Orthodox women, didn't go to mikvah because the mikvahs were dirty and unhygienic. So the point of this book is to teach people how to construct their own mikvah in their house. Every house will have their own mikvah. It has a preface by Bernard Revo. It has the skemas from the Ramaz, and it's quite an interesting volume. And it's the first such book by a modern Orthodox person on Jewish law. Let me read you the one passage, because written in 1930, I was actually embarrassed when I read this passage, because it's a reflection of pre-Hitlerite eugenics. He's talking about why Orthodox Jews should not use birth control, and he says, the formal practice of birth control by the intelligent would mean the surrender of our civilization and progress to the inferior races and the uneducated and the illiterate would soon predominate. So, I mean, this sort of language, which was common before World War II, but other than that, it's a fascinating book, and it's really a landmark in the history of Orthodoxy in America. I'm going to turn my mic down a bit here. So let me move on back to Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog writes to Rav Unterman about this thing about the blood. He says, quote, "I am almost embarrassed and ashamed by what you wrote," that is by what Rav Unterman wrote, that we don't take blood tests seriously, because what the Gemara says, that blood comes from the mother. "How can there be a question of the credibility of the doctors in a matter which has been clearly accepted by all the giants of medicine throughout the world?" He then explains that in matters like this, the sages were guided by the sages, as we said last week, that their job was to learn. And when they had a medical question, they went to the top scientists of their day. He doesn't say anything about nature having changed here, because that's not, you can't use this argument in this case. He then writes, quote, "How unfortunate it is that while science is progressively conquering worlds and discovering all sorts of secrets, although it too errs at times, we bury our hands in the sand, like the well-known bird, you know, the ostrich, and look no further with regard to scientific matters that concern our holy Torah. It is imperative that we should nurture from among the prodigies studying in the yeshivas men of science in each discipline, so that we will not need others in matters of chemistry, physiology, electricity, and everything to do with the Torah." So what Rav Herzog was saying, that the great, you have to take the Eluhim and train them in the sciences so they can answer questions of Jewish law. You know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, although he wasn't trained scientifically, we know he gave himself a huge education in science. He would speak to the physics students. Rav Soloveitchik used to say, and this is a quote here from Walter Wurzberger, he didn't know how to poskin on questions of electricity because he didn't know if it should be understood in accordance with the undular theory or the quantum theory. Now, I'm not a scientist myself, so I don't know those two theories, but the point is that he knew enough to know that he didn't know. And that's what Rav Herzog was talking about, that you really need to, you can't just be a post-it without knowing the science. Already we see a real distinction between him and other post-scheme. Now regarding, let's go back now to Jewish law and the State of Israel. As I said in the last class, Rav Herzog knew that for Jewish law to be accepted in the State of Israel, certain changes would have to take place because the population as a whole simply would not accept it. And the most prominent, and it's the subject of a long article in this volume I pointed out last week, called The Halachic Thought of Rav Isaac Herzog, deals with inheritance. That is, that if you have men and women, according to Torah law, the women do not inherit, just the men inherit. In fact, this law was ignored in Europe as well. And Rav Herzog mentions a scandal that happened when the children of the Hasidic Rebbe, the sons that is, insisted on getting all the inheritance themselves. And everyone was talking about how evil these men were, and it created a big Chil Hashem. I mentioned that the rabbis of Spain in 1494 passed a takana allowing daughters, unmarried daughters, to inherit, the assumption being that the married daughters would be taken care of. The rabbis of Morocco did the same thing in the 1950s. And the entire second volume of Rav Herzog's proposed constitution deals with this issue, trying to change inheritance law. Of course, it's not so simple. To go against Torah law, to uproot Torah law because of what modern people think, and there's a discussion among the poskim, long time before Rav Herzog, do contemporary rabbis even have the authority to uproot Torah law? Chazal could do that, but do later rabbis? And it created great controversy, because then where then do you draw the line? If you're going to create a takana to go around Torah law for in the matter of inheritance, in Ladav Asof, where do you stop? Now, the opposition to Rav Herzog was especially opposed to any law that would give in to the mindset of the modern world. It's one thing if people like Heteriska, you're dealing with religious people that who don't want to lend money without getting interest, so you create something. But in the modern world, there were notions of feminism, there was rebellion against Torah. That's a very different conception of a takana. And the Haredim believed it was the matzav, the social circumstances that needed to be changed. But Rav Herzog's attitude was, the takanot have always been because the people are not behaving the way that maybe they should, and therefore the Torah has to respond to that, and the rabbis need to create takanot. And as I mentioned, there's this book by Shapansky, 4 volumes, giving all the takanot. I mean, they could have said that if people are not lending money on interest, then fine, and no one will get loans, but they created the heteriska. Now, this, I don't believe in all Jewish history until the 20th century, there ever was a notion of opposition to takanot, the ideological opposition. I'm not referring to opposition to this takana or that takana, but ideological opposition to the very notion that we can make takanot. And yet the Haredim were arguing in Israel that we no longer have the authority to make takanot, both because we are no longer worthy, and also because the environment we're in, the takanot are being made to reward sinners. Sammy, your question, that's exactly what we're talking about. So let me continue, and then we'll come back to your question. The essence of all takanot, though, is, of course, that the law as it stands on the books isn't working. And the dispute between Rav Herzog and his opponents was fundamentally this. Are you concerned with a small group of religious Jews, and therefore you keep things the way they are, or is your concern for the larger community? For the Haredim, you don't change Jewish law, you don't make adjustments because you're trying to help people, because of how people who are not totally committed are going to respond. The only time you do things like this is when you're dealing with a completely religious community. If you have a more wider conception, then you take into account the wider community, you come to a different conclusion. That's obviously an issue still affecting us. In my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I show how that was the issue over the argument over stunning before Shlita. Rabbi Weinberg thought we have to worry about the people who are not so orthodox, that if we ban Shlita, if we don't have some heter, they'll start eating treif. And his opponents thought that our job is to keep a pure halakha, not adopt kulas for those people who are not 100%. Now, Rav Herzog, he developed these takanot. I can't go into the lumdus here. There was almost like a grama of sorts that you put it in the ketubah, etc., and the ketubah says that the people have to follow what the government law is, and the Knesset was going to pass the law. But at the end of the day, what it did was declare that women and men inherit equally, and there was the same lumdus that you can use to sell your chametz or all these things, to sell the land during Shemitah. He developed a way to, and there are many rabbanim who agreed with that. There were those who disagreed with him. Atakana, he remember what I said, that he wanted Jewish law to be the law of Israel. Choshen Mishpat should be the law of the state. Unless inheritance law was equalized, certainly the non-religious would never accept it, and most of the religious would not accept it either, because in modern times it didn't make sense to them. It was one thing when girls were married at 14 years old and they had husbands, but today when women were living on their own for many years and people had much more wealth to distribute, it didn't seem fair to them, and therefore Rav Herzog said, we need to issue a takana. I will tell you that Rav Ovadia Yosef accepted this when the Iranian community in the 70s wanted to create takanot. That Rav Ovadia Yosef accepted Rav Herzog's approach. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who, according to many, is the leading halakhic authority alive today. When the RCA has a question, the Aguda goes to Rav Yosef, they go to Rav Zalman Nechemia. If you want to see Rav Zalman Nechemia, you can go to the Yeshivas Beit El's website, where they have some 5,000 shiurim, and they have many, many shiurim from Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. He's hardly a Haredi, many people believe he is the greatest halakhic authority in the world today. And as I said, he accepted this takana is a valid takana based upon proper argumentation. So this idea that this is somehow undermining of Torah, it all depends on your outlook. For Rav Avadi and Rav Zalman Achemya, this is simply using the tools that Chazal gave the rabbis to issue takanot to respond to the contemporary circumstances. No different than any of the other takanot that have been issued. Rabbis have issued takanot not permitting, according to Jewish law, if a guy goes and betroths a woman, marries her, all you need are two witnesses. Rabbis in many countries pass takanot that unless there's a minyan there, unless the rabbi is there, unless the parents are there, the marriage does not take effect. Hold on a second. The marriage does not take effect. And you could say, well, how is that possible? How could you say the marriage doesn't take effect? They were Mekadei Shanisha, according to Halacha, because the rabbis have this authority. There's Hefker based in Hefker. They could take away the value of the Pruta. They have all sorts of ways. So, according to, so I've heard said, it's certainly following in one path. Now, I didn't hear. Well, someone's going to say? Someone was... Yeah, but this is just like you can't go to a coast. You could say, well, I'm having a monetary dispute with someone. I can go to a secular court. And no, because the secular court will decide against Torah law and money will be removed from a person even against what the Torah would give them. And even if you say, well, we both agree, it doesn't matter because we don't assume it's a real agreement. The same thing, this is Yerusha, this is stealing, because you could say you're stealing from the sons who, and the daughter, you're stealing from the sons. That is, the government's coming in, and it's not the people making the agreement, it's the government saying, or the rabbi saying, that the inheritance is going to go to the children. If without that, how are you going to get out of it? It's a geneva. You're stealing the proper inheritance that belongs to the son. So you need to do some sort of universal takana. If the brothers agree themselves, that's fine. But otherwise, they can insist on Torah law that they can get their inheritance. No, he never allowed annulling marriages. No one dealt with annulling marriages really in that day, except for on an individual cases, certainly not globally. I will tell you that the Tzitz Eliezer, who has a tshuva against this takana of Rav Herzog, he does say, however, quite interestingly, maybe even self-contradictory, that if the government does pass the law, as was the case obviously in Europe, if a woman inherits and the sons come and say, we want the property, she does not have to give it back to him, and she can insist that he pays her, and it doesn't violate any halacha. You can't. He quotes Acharonim who say this. He himself doesn't take a position. So you already have Acharonim who said that if the woman is giving it to her, the government, the secular government, that is a non-Jewish government, does, then they themselves have the right to take it away and give it to the women. So it's quite interesting. Now, Rav Herzog also dealt with the issue of witness testimony. I mentioned it last class, but I want to repeat it because of a new aspect. Last class we spoke about how he argued that when you look at what makes witnesses invalid, you can't just say that they're not Shomer Shabbos. You have to note that today, people who are not Shomer Shabbos could be just as moral as anyone else. Now, Rav Ozio was also interested in this issue, and he is a tshuva, so he doesn't even go that direction of Rav Herzog. He simply says that the Knesset, which acts as the authority of the Jewish people, the representative, they can pass laws. And their laws have the authority, just like the rabbis make takanot, the Knesset makes a takana, and they say that everyone can be a witness, everyone's testimony counts. And Rav Herzog dealt with this as well, after hearing, I presume, Rav Uziel's argument, because he adds on to his original argument and says that, yes, the Knesset has the authority. So here you have Zionist Rabbanim, saying that a government body comprised of mostly non-Orthodox Jews have the authority to issue rules that allow normally pasul witnesses to be accepted. Now, witnesses, we know, can always be accepted if the people agree to. But here, the government, the Knesset, is acting on their behalf. It's not like each time I say I accept these witnesses. The government decides that I will accept these witnesses. And that has significance. Obviously, from the Haredi perspective, the law of the Knesset is meaningless. Yes, women are witnesses. According to that, yes, according to Rav Herzog, according to Rav Uziel, women are witnesses. 100%. Except for, Rav Herzog said, in marriage, when you come to a question of a marriage. Because that's completely within the status of the Rabbanut, And that's a religious issue. There's no issue of momonos here, and it's not the same thing. But in monetary matters and courts, there is no difference whatsoever. And that's the P'sak Halacha L'maisa. Now, Rav Herzog, though, always phrases, you're right, it's not Ne'amanut in a technical halachic sense. It's giving information, which is why if we choose to accept it, it's valid. The chiddush here is that the Knesset can determine that we will accept it, and you can't get up and say, no, I choose not to accept this testimony, and no Dayan could say that. I mean, the Knesset has authority to change the way Batei Dinim work. Now, Rav Herzog always phrases his acceptance of this takana and others by, fortunately we live in an era where people won't accept, the old law. But it's hard not to get the sense that he thought these takanot were good. After all, he acknowledges, he says that in modern times, people will not accept this. And he also believes that we're not supposed to live in a ghetto. We're not supposed to go back to the olden days, that it's good that we're living in a modern state. Well, by definition, then, if we're living in a modern state, and that's the way Rav Herzog thinks we should be living, then people are not going to live like they're in the ghetto, and they're going to demand more equality for their daughters, etc. So it's almost, I get the sense almost that these arguments that he puts forward at the end, that unfortunately we need to make these takanot, it's not really being frank. Rav Herzog also says that the State of Israel was established at the approval of the United Nations, and therefore we must follow basic laws that all civilized nations accept today. That means there's no discrimination on the basis of religion. We can't say that non-Jews can't be witnesses, or non-Jews can't run for political office. We can't say that women. So he throws the UN in here as well, which is interesting. Now, Blitzstein, Gerald Blitzstein, a great scholar, he just won Pras Yisrael last year, Israel's highest intellectual award for his writings on the Rambam and Jewish law. I don't think he's into Toronto yet. He wrote a whole article on this, dealing with Rav Herzog, and he writes, quote, Rav Herzog's basic rejection of democratic ideals, which are tolerable only under compulsion, of a rather indirect source, to be sure. I mean, and he goes on, saying that Rav Herzog accepts these democratic ideals because it's under compulsion. This is even though that Blitzstein also shows that Rav Herzog speaks very positively about democracy. But I really disagree here. I don't think it's a contradiction. Poskim often will use the means at their disposal to reach a certain conclusion, even if they don't necessarily agree with it. For example, the halachic system doesn't always provide a way to get from place A to place B. So if Herzog might use an argument that he might not necessarily feel so comfortable with, but at the end of the day, it gets him to where he wants to go, that you can adopt this takana. In general, I think, when you look at poskim, you have to look at the conclusions, not the arguments. Sometimes poskim will use arguments that you might say, well, we save a non-Jew on Shabbos because they won't save us, and look at the conclusions. A posik has to work within the system. So I don't see this as really a tension. Every posik knows that. You work within the system. And that doesn't mean necessarily that you're comfortable with all the arguments you're using. You have to look at the end. So I don't know if I agree with Professor Blitzstein. Rav Herzog also throws in the point we mentioned last class, that democratic society, we're speaking with a reminder, we mentioned this, a democratic society is not the same as a monarchy, it's not Sarara, it's not this sort of rulership, all these offices are temporary, our whole court systems, we live in these covenantal communities where we agree to set up these systems, we're not being decided from on top, we elect our leaders, so therefore we're in a totally different society. The old laws, as recorded in Hilchos Malachim with the Rambam, don't apply in a society where we're all part of the society together. How then to run a modern society? Well, Rav Herzog calls attention to a very interesting theory of the Ran, Rav Nissim Garandi, 14th century great Spanish sage. The Ran has a famous book called Drushot HaRan, which are not drushot like we think of, but they're long essays on Halacha and Agada. And in one of his drushot, he claims that there are two types of governance. Torah law is one, and the law of the king is the other, and these are parallel, and we might call the law of the king realistic law. they operate in two separate spheres. So, for example, in Torah law, you need two witnesses to convict someone. He needs to be in for crime. He needs to be warned ahead of time. The king, however, the Ron says, can set up any legal system he wants that he thinks will work. And that's the way the Ron thinks Jewish society in ancient times worked, and that's the way it'll work in Messianic. That's the way Jewish law works. You have two systems of law operating simultaneously. You have Torah law, and you have the king's law. And this king's law is granted not to the Sanhedrin, but to the king. And the reason is because Torah law just simply doesn't work, as I'll explain, in society. And that I'll tell you what his theory is, why there is Torah law then. He says this is the problem of when they went to Samuel and they demanded a king, and Samuel's all upset. Why should he be upset? It says in Devarim, then they come into the land of Israel, they're gonna want a king. And Ron explains that what they wanted was just the king's law. They didn't want Torah law in addition to the king's law. What is the theory? Well, the theory is, according to the Ron, that you have this Torah law, and it's an ideal. It's almost like, you might even say it's a utopian thing, a messianic type of thing, that in theory, this is the way we want to run our life, that you need two witnesses, and you need to warn him and all this, but in the real world, we know you can't run a society with that type of system. No one's going to ever go to jail. No, you can't. And therefore, you need the king's law. The king's law is the real law. The Torah law is the theoretical law, Drush HaKabbalah. It's the law we study. It's the ideal law. But it's not supposed to be the real law. The real law is the king's law, and the king's law can be adjusted. If the people improve themselves, then you can add a little more Torah law in. But there's this dialectic continuously between Torah law and realistic law, and realistic law only allows as much Torah law in as the people are ready to handle. And this isn't a revolt against Torah law, according to the Ron. This is how the system was originally intended. And from his perspective, the proof is so obvious, because the Torah is the way we're supposed to live. Obviously, you can't live in a society where someone can only be punished if he was seen by two male witnesses who warned him ahead of time, you know that when you kill this person, you're going to be convicted. That's not real world. So obviously, the Ron feels from the very beginning you need to have realistic law. Yes, he's saying Torah law is not for Olam Hazeh. Torah law is what we strive for. But until, like, Messianic days, we can never reach it because it's not realistic law. And throughout Jewish history, the courts have followed the Ron's perspective, although, like I said, he thought it was a thing that should be. With the courts, when I say they followed the Ron's perspective, they have not followed Torah law. But they had to, for the Ron, they can only do it on an ad hoc basis, as I'll explain. Whereas the ruler, this is part of built into the system. Now, what do I mean by ad hoc? They exist in separate realms. I'm not going to say it supersedes, because in theory, Torah law is the law. It's just that society can't live that way. And therefore, you have the king's law. But the king's law is not something invented. This is basic to the system. It's not, when I say, the Rambam already mentions that everyone says that the courts can break Torah law. And they quote the Talmud. The Talmud has a story that a man was riding a horse on Shabbos, and the rabbis killed him for that. And they ask, how could the rabbis have given him the death penalty? Riding a horse is a rabbinic prohibition. You don't get the death penalty for that. And the rabbi said the times required it. That is, if you think that it's an emergency, that religion is going to fall apart, if people see a guy riding a horse, everyone's going to start violating Shabbos, you can then break with the Torah procedures on an emergency basis. That's what the courts can do, according to the Ron, but the king doesn't need to be emergency basis. It's a continuous system of law. And that's how Jewish courts operated, though. They operated on this continuous emergency basis, this ad hoc basis. No, I would say like the Prizbul. The Prizbul, they invented a legal fiction, so you're not really violating anything. It's a way of getting around it. This is not getting around Torah law. This is simply saying that there's Torah law, but in our world, we're supposed to follow realistic law, because Torah law is when we're ready for Torah law. And with the court case, these are harat shah, these are emergency measures. Ah, yes, Rabbi Kelman points out very interestingly that Rav Kook held that the representatives of the people have the authority of like a Sanhedrin, etc. So that would also give them this authority to carry out laws. But understand that we have this conception that the Sanhedrin would follow Torah law. And even the Ron says the Sanhedrin follows Torah law, but the king, according to Rav Kook, you're right, the king is represented now by the Knesset. That's Rav Kook's big chiddush, that he didn't have the Knesset. The parliament takes the place of the king as the representative, and therefore, according to Rav Kook, based upon the Ron, Knesset could pass laws. All these laws are valid. You can't say, well, I don't accept these laws because the Torah law doesn't accept that. And even the Ron, he wasn't just referring to the king, he was referring to government. I don't know when the Haredim say that it should be based on Torah law. I'm not sure what they mean by Torah law, because as I just said, the Ron held that you don't have Torah law. And there never was a court. When Jews had autonomy, and they had autonomy in Spain, they had autonomy in the Islamic world, they punished people. They gave people lashes. How can they give people lashes? They don't have smicha. They did terrible things, by the way, in Spain. They cut off tongues, they disfigured people, which they took from the non-Jews. I mean, there were certain Jewish courts that did stuff that today would turn our stomach, but that was what they did in those days. How could they do this? These are not things that are found in the Torah or in Chazal, because the courts have the authority from the rabbis to do whatever they need to do to keep order. So when you say to go according to Torah law, I don't know, every single Jewish court in history, when they had autonomy, when they ran themselves, none of them ran according to Torah law. They all ran according to Harat Shah law. I don't want to say the king's law, because the Ron applies it to government, but maybe it would apply here too, because some of these autonomous Jewish communities, they were their own governments. They ran like themselves. So then none of them ran according to Torah law. So I don't know what that means. Does that mean that in a Haredi state, no one would be able to be arrested, be convicted? And I'll quote you in just 1 minute. Rav Chaim Ozer says to Rav Herzog, we can't run a Torah state. I'll read this to you in a second. Sharia. But Sharia law is very, it's efficient. They do execute people all the time. They don't have these problems. So I don't know what Torah law means, because as I said, Torah law, according to, if you just look at it, it's almost like it's a messianic law. We can't keep law and order. We can't keep criminals running around by Torah law. That's why you need either the king's law, which the Ron says is basic, or you need what the Rambam says, this emergency law. But of course, if you're in today's day and age, the emergency law, Harat Shah, becomes the law. Just like we study Torah Shabbat, we write it down, even though it's an emergency law. But since we need to write it down, it's become the practice. Even for the Rambam and the Ron, whatever the justification is, they both agree that you do not follow Torah law, because Torah law will not allow you to have a system running properly. We're not righteous. Torah law is for righteous people. Now, is there anyone writing about this today? Well, yeah, there's, we have Shochet Min has an article, one of the Orthodox Forum articles, where he quotes Rav Brzezinski, or Chaim Ozer, I'll tell you in just 1 minute, disagreed with Rav Herzog on this very issue. But before I go even say this, let me just tell you something. I was at a shul where the rabbi, a very big Ramdan, was talking at Shal Shudas all about Torah law and how it's so hard it is to convict people. And you had these lawyers there, and you had someone who was a DA. And he says, I don't understand, you can never convict people. And the rabbi is saying, well, that's our Torah. The rabbi, he knew so much theoretical halacha, he didn't know anything about the history of tshuva, Jewish law. Look in the Rosh, look in the Maram, the Lubin, all of them, they all state that we have to go beyond Torah law, and they all instituted penalties, lashes, other punishments, because Torah law does not work when you have biryomi, when you have people who don't follow it. It only works when people are righteous people and they're willing to be put into line. So this idea that you get up as a rabbi and you tell people, basically you make them think that the Jewish law is idiotic, that we can never run a Jewish state according to Jewish law because every criminal will get away. So now, moving on. I mean, maybe some people think that this is like, if I say that, you go, in addition to Torah law, they'll say this isn't from, but that just shows they don't know their history. Rav Herzog, after he became chief rabbi, had correspondence with Rav Chaim Ozer about well, about this very issue. What are we going to do when we have a state? How can we run a state? And Rav Chaim Moser was the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage in the world, the leading Halachic authority. He died in 1940 during the war, but he wasn't killed. He was buried in a Jewish cemetery. He wrote to Rav Herzog. First of all, he says, we know what the problem is. According to the Torah, if you steal and you're caught, you don't go to jail. You, according to the rabbis, you pay double, kefil. So obviously this is a problem. You could rob from five houses, and then you get caught, you pay double, you're still up. And Rav Herzog says, we can't obviously run a society in the state of in Israel, the future state, where you just pay double. And then Rav Chaim Moser says, and what about being moda? According to Halacha, before the trial comes, if you confess, you're off scot-free. And can you imagine every criminal who's caught is going to confess, and then no one's ever convicted. So Rav Chaim Moser says, we have to follow the Ron's position, that set up, we'll follow the king's law. And that's what, so you say Torah law, Rav Chaim Moser, who is the leading scholar of the Haredim, said just the opposite. In the new state, because they knew a state was coming in 1939, 1940, he says, we're not going to do Torah law, we have to do the Ron's position of the king's law. Now, Rav Herzog was very upset with this. Now, why was Rav Herzog upset? Because, one more thing I want to say, this is not usurping Torah law. This is simply showing, this is the Torah law, according to the Ron, that there's two types of laws. There's the Torah law, and then there's the realistic law. But Rav Herzog opposed Rav Chaim Moser, because Rav Chaim Moser is not a Zionist. Rav Chaim Moser is a very practical person. There's going to be a state, it's going to be non-religious. How can you run the state properly? You need to have the king's law. Rav Herzog wanted a state in which the rabbis would be involved in planning laws and be involved in issuing laws. He wanted it to be as much a Torah state as possible. Rav Chaim Moser, according to Rav Herzog, was throwing in the towel. He was acknowledging before they even started that there's no place for the rabbis in formulating the law of the state of Israel. In other words, it's just going to be whatever the government decides, the king's law. For Rav Herzog, and Rav Chaim Moser, I said, had no stake in this established state. But Rav Herzog saw the state as the beginning of the redemption. He is the one who wrote the prayer for the state of Israel, according to all evidence. He put in the words, the Reshit Smichat Guatenu. He wanted to create a Torah legal system, as best as you can. And therefore, at the end of trying to achieve this, he'll maybe come to certain conclusions, accept the Rambam here, the Ron here, but to throw in the towel before we even start and say that we're just going to say that let the state establish whatever rules it wants to, it's the king's law. Rav Herzog saying that's just throwing religion completely out of the state, and he was very unhappy that Rav Chaim Moser was actually arguing in favor of removing Torah from state-run laws. Rav Chaim Moser would say he's being realistic, but Rav Herzog's perspective was it's throwing in the towel, because it's one thing at the end to come to this conclusion, but Rav Herzog wanted to see if we can have the rabbis involved. Rav Herzog thought that rabbis should be involved in the Knesset. When they pass laws, the rabbis should give their input. We spoke about last week how he spoke about how the police force runs on Shabbos. Well, he wants to be involved. That's the whole point of all these takanot, about bringing women into the electoral process, all this. I mean, the idea that we're just going to say that the rabbis don't have to write tshuvot, he doesn't have to write a constitution to show how we can count non-Jews, because according to Rav Chaim Moser, you don't need a constitution, a Jewish constitution. You don't need Rav Herzog's three volumes. Just let the secular government do whatever they want to do. That's the king's law. Rav Herzog's whole point was that we want a Torah state. And in a Torah state, can deal with all these issues too. It just takes a lot of work. Yes, Simcha Asaf was on the Supreme Court. He was a great Talmud Chacham from Telz. He tried to bring Mishpat Ivri, Jewish law, to the Supreme Court. That's what Rav Herzog wanted. Rav Herzog was very close to Simcha Asaf. He wanted religious Jews, Rabbanim, Talmid Chachamim, to be involved in creating civil law. And Rav Chaim Moser was just as happy to say it's the king's law. When Mashiach comes, we'll have Torah law. Now we have the king's law. Rav Herzog also takes up this, in the midst of his discussions about the state, how important the state is going to be, because he obviously was around before the state, and when the state came into being, he takes up the anti-Zionist argument, which hopefully we'll get to with the Sat Marav, that you're not allowed to have a state before the Messianic era. And I'll leave aside now all of the substantial arguments he offers against this, but he gives another argument. He says, even assuming the Satmar are correct, and that it's wrong to establish a state before Messianic days, that's only in a situation, a regular situation. But when it's Bikuach Nefesh, saving life, that pushes aside all other commandments. So certainly, having a state today, he says, is Pikuach Nefesh. It's about saving Jews' lives. Had there been a state during World War II, think of all the Jews who would have been saved. And he also says something even, not just physical Pikuach Nefesh, spiritual. In the years after World War II, do you realize how many Jews just gave up religion? How many Jews converted? How many Jews just assimilated? Who wanted to be Jewish? Rav Herzog writes about how the state of Israel gave Jews pride. The pride that Jews felt in the early 1950s of what it meant to have a Jewish state, that's a spiritual pikuach nefesh. And so you're going to tell me that because there's some obscure passage in the Talmud, we can't have a state when we could save lives? It made no sense for him. Then he gave another argument, which is very relevant today. He said that today our enemies are the Muslim world, and even more so today than when he said it. And it's very important to have a state, and don't tell me people, the Satmar and others were arguing that we can't have a state, because if you have a state, that means you have to have the idolatrous churches in it, and all these sorts of things. And leaving aside the issue, which he shows that Christianity is not idolatry for Christians, he says today the most fundamental issue is that Jews are threatened with extermination by the surrounding Muslims, and our only friends are the Christians. And therefore, we must argue in favor of the position that has a more positive view to Christianity. There's the Rambam's view that has a very negative position, and then the Tosafists had a more positive outlook. And he tells you that this is Pikuach Nefesh today, that the Christians will be our only friends. And therefore, there can be no discrimination, there can be none of these issues that pre-modern halachas spoke about. We must avoid Chil Hashem in every way. Now, Itamar Varhaftig, another scholar in Israel who wrote an article on Rav Herzog, points out that Rav Herzog never speaks about changing Jewish law or outlooks because of, quote, the spirit of the times. He only speaks about Chil Hashem. It'll be a Chil Hashem if the non-religious see this. It'll be a Chil Hashem if the non-Jews see it. But Varhaftig points out that what's the definition of Chil Hashem? Chil Hashem is subjective. In our day and age, something is regarded as a Chil Hashem, which in previous years it wasn't. So, willy-nilly, for Rav Herzog, the spirit of the age is what determines his outlook on a number of these issues. That it's a Chil Hashem, so therefore that means that in today's day and age, it's not acceptable. That means the spirit of the age is really moving Rav Herzog in many directions. So we have Rav Herzog engaged in an effort, we'll see the Chazon Ish very opposed, to update halacha, to revise halacha in accordance with new moral conceptions like we saw with Weinberg. Now, and these are loaded terms I'm using because we're confronted now with the conservative movement and reform who use these terms to try to make their own changes in halacha. But from an internal halachic perspective, Rav Herzog is operating in a very traditional fashion. For example, by the way, this notion of Rav Herzog, of updating halacha, doesn't just lead to kulos, it leads to chumros as well, stringencies. Let me give you a good stringency. Rav Herzog said, well, first of all, the halacha is that if someone converts for the sake of marriage, the marriage is valid, and that the conversion is valid. Even if it's done for the sake of marriage, the Talmud says you're not supposed to convert people for the sake of marriage, but if it's done, the conversion is valid. Why? Because the person will be part of the observant community, and the person will then, in those days, in pre-modern times, when you converted, you're in the Jewish community. You have to be religious, because you're in a religious community. Rav Herzog, that's the reason Rav Herzog explains why it's valid. Based upon this, he says, in today's day and age, it doesn't apply anymore. You can convert to Judaism for the sake of marriage, and there's no assumption you'll still be from. You will be religious. There's no assumption you'll ever be religious. And therefore, even though the poskim, all the poskim say, this goes back to the Talmudic halacha also, that if you convert for the sake of marriage, it's a valid conversion. Rav Herzog says he doesn't think so anymore. He disagrees with the halacha, thousands of years halacha, and he says that in today's day and age, if you convert for the sake of marriage and you're not religious, it's an invalid conversion. Because the whole point why the earlier rabbis permitted it was because when you converted, you were going to be in a community of religious people, and you, by definition, would be a religious person and raise a religious family. That no longer exists today, such communities. You can convert for the sake of marriage and be like everyone else. So here we have Rav Herzog using his ideas of updating halacha with changing norms for a chumrah. This tshuva of his was actually published for the first time in the writings of the Chelkos Yaakov, Rav Breish, who was almost like a Satmar-type posek. So you see Rav Herzog, halacha changes, but not just lakula. This creates incredible chumras as well. So let me just conclude then, for Rav Herzog, he believed that Jewish law could work in a modern state. We don't have to choose between halacha and modern principles. We don't have to adopt the Rav Chaim Ozer approach of let the secularists run the government. No, we should try to work on creating a Jewish state, a Torah state. It's a hard work, but that's what the rabbis have always done. Go back to the halachic sources, see how they can be made relevant for the changing circumstances, try to work on takanot, and that's his legacy. And now if there's any questions, we will have a few minutes at least be able to introduce the Chazon Ish. His approach in his lifetime was put in place. We talk about banning of Yibum. The takanot were not put in place. So some weren't. His ideas of Yibum, banning Yibum, were then rejected by Ravad Yosef. I will say that some of his takanot, the age of marriage, the allowing witnesses, every based in Israel today accepts a testimony of the non-religious people, etc. However, his inheritance thing never got off the ground, and Rav Herzog was very bitter because he thought that had they been able to make this takana about inheritance, Choshen Mishpat would have been the law of the land. You wouldn't have needed a Simcha Asaf putting Choshen Mishpat on. You could have had Jewish courts with just Jewish law updated, obviously, in accordance with, because all law needs to be updated, in accordance with Torah procedures, and you wouldn't need Anglo law or Turkish law, etc. He believed that it was primarily because the Orthodox refused to budge on the inheritance issue, that the non-religious said, fine, we'll create our own court systems. If you want to go to Basin, go to Basin. And that crushed Rav Herzog, because what type of state is this? What type of Jewish state it is? Is it when Torah law is not having any involvement? No, I don't think he came to accept Chaim Ozer's position because, I mean, in the real world, he saw this wasn't happening. Obviously, these laws had validity. But he always believed that, and that's why he wrote a 3-volume work, that if the rabbis were given the authority and the rabbis were willing to make use of the power of Takana, that they could solve these problems and they could bring Torah values into the running of the state and you wouldn't need a secular king's law to run. Remember, the king's law is not Torah. The king can do whatever he wants. He doesn't need to follow any Torah procedures. And Rav Herzog thought that was, I don't think I'm too sharp if I say he thought it was a chil Hashem, that to have the king's law in the land of Israel. It's one thing to have the king's law in the diaspora, but in the new state of Israel that he thought was going to be a messianic state, because he said that there can never be a third destruction, to have the king's law in it, you're not going to have complete Torah law. Obviously, you can't have you can't say that you need 2 witnesses and all this, but at least you can work on it through Torah law. You can make takanot. You can work through the Torah system and come up with solutions. So that's what I would say about that. Okay, well, we have 2 minutes, so let me just introduce the Chazon Ish, if only to say, as Rav Herzog was regarded as the Gadol Hador, at the leading sage for the religious Zionist world, the Chazon Ish was the great opponent. I don't mean opponents in the sense they were personal opponents, on the contrary, but the Chazon Ish was the Gadol of the non-Zionist Orthodox world, and everything we spoke about with Rav Kook and Rav Herzog, we'll see that the Chazon Ish has an exact opposite position. And he was the most outstanding, what was Rav Herzog's view? Rav Herzog was very opposed to the Sanhedrin, but all the people who were close to Rav Herzog, at least I think, they believed he was afraid. He was very nervous because the Haredim, Rav Herzog was very attentive to what the Haredim had to say. I think in theory, referred to site fault the Sanhedrin was a good idea, but in today's day and age, you couldn't have it. There was too much controversy, so he did not support Rav Maimon Sanhedrin. And we'll see why the Chazon Ish was very opposed to it. The Chazon Ish was not just the most important Haredi figure, and the word Haredi really, it's an anachronism, because you didn't have Haredim in those days like you have today. The term is a bit anachronistic, but we'll use it. He was the leading figure of the non-Zionist Orthodox, and to this day, he is the most important figure in the Haredi world, the most important figure of all time. I mean, he's the one who created the Haredi approach to the state of Israel. He crafted it. Haredi Judaism in Israel is very much a Chazon Ish type Judaism. Had they not, just like we said in America, if you didn't have Rav Aaron Kotler, Orthodoxy would have developed differently. If instead of the Chazon Ish, Rav Kahaneman from Ponevez was the gadol of the Haredim, it would have been very different. I mean, he had a flag in the front of the yeshiva. Had the Rav Yecheskel Sarna, it would have been very different. We will see how the Chazon Ish, but he changed the future. Unlike with Herzog, whose legacy has pretty much been forgotten, the Chazon Ish's influence has continued to grow, and the community of scholars, to use Menachem Friedman's term, which he so much loved, which was so small in his day, I think there was 200 people learning full-time, now we're up to something like 40,000 people, and this is all an outgrowth of the ideology of the Chazon Ish, which we will pick up next class, and we might be able to do it in a class and a half. So I think it's already 10. We'll stop here. If there's any questions or comments on what we said today, next class, as I said, we'll really do the Chazon Ish, so that should be exciting.
All right.
Rav Herzog had a very mild personality, extremely mild. As did the Chazon Ish, we'll see. Rav Herzog was not he had a presence, a great presence, but he had a very mild personality. He was, to a certain extent, stepped on by people. You mentioned Rav Maimon. Rav Maimon hated him. Rav Maimon stepped on him. He was stepped on. The Mizrahi movement stepped on him. They ignored things he said when they didn't want to listen to it. And he wasn't a forceful personality. I mean, it was his tzidkus, his great, and his scholarship that stood out. But he was not one of these. He was a very mild-mannered person. And so that also, I think, had a lot to do with the fact why he wasn't successful. He when the Chazon Ish came out very strongly, he didn't want to disagree with the Chazon Ish. He was a very mild-mannered person, yes. Good night. Okay, well then we'll say good night and.
All right. Good night. I'll ask you off. I'm just curious why Rav Maimon, as you put it, hated him. That's a
hate is a strong word. In Hebrew, you say sana. It implies also dislike. First of all, Rav Maimon was a follower of Rav Kook, and he wanted Rav Harlap to become chief rabbi. So the bad blood started then. But more fundamentally, Rav Maimon regarded himself as the leader of religious Zionism. He's the old Mizrahi person, and he was a big Talmud Chacham. He wanted to make policy. And Rav Herzog was the big adversary. Not that Rav Herzog wanted to be an adversary, but Rav Maimon could never be the gadol of the religious Zionists as long as Rav Herzog was there. And Rav Maimon tried to make waves. He attached the Brisker Rav. He attacked. So Rav Maimon had real problems with Rav Herzog, and he spoke about against him. There's all sorts of stories about Rav Maimon and the way he treated Rav Herzog. He stepped on him. The Mizrahi is supposed to listen to the chief rabbi. Rav Herzog would make the decisions, and Rav Maimon would tell people, "We don't have to listen to him. You know, I make the decisions here." So there were articles, and I was looking for articles from Rabbi Weinberg. I went to the old newspapers and in the 50s, and you saw articles in the Aguda papers telling Rav Herzog, why do you remain with these Mizrahi people? Look how they treat you. Look how Maimon treats you with such disrespect. Come to us. We are your community. We know how to give Kavod HaTorah. The Mizrahi doesn't understand what Kavod HaTorah is. And when they say the Mizrahi, they mean Maimon. Maimon didn't know, you know, but that's what it comes down to. Rav Maimon was a great Talmud Chacham, no question about it. But you can't compare him to Rav Herzog. They were right about that? About what?
About how they treat their gedolim that's supposed to have the the modern Orthodox Church Church of Bellevue. Absolutely.
No, you're right, you're right. But Rav Maimon had a famous comment. Rav Maimon said that basically, Maimon's position was, if you want to know if you can use a tea bag, go ask him. But if you want to know on the larger issues affecting the Jewish community, then we're going to tell them. They wanted to turn the rabbis into just functionaries. So there's no question that the Mizrahi lowered the status of the rabbis. They thought that the chief rabbinate was supposed to be their tool, and when Rav Herzog didn't go along with them on certain issues, they basically pushed him aside. And so he was not a very happy existence.
And the Rav understood that, of course, which is probably why he didn't want to become, you know, chief rabbi. The Rav fully understood he would be a politician.
That's what he said. He said he didn't want to be, at the beck and call of these people. And Weinberg said the same thing. He said he didn't want to get involved with the Mizrahi because Aguda does it to their people maybe too, not as bad, but I think we can acknowledge the Mizrahi was a political party, and they used their rabbis. Yes, the Rav did not want to get in a situation where he'd be taking orders from functionaries. That is correct. And he saw what happened to Rav Herzog.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Mark, we'll let you have a good night.
I will say, though, it's funny, just the Mossad Harav Kook, which was founded by Rav Maimon, maybe as an act of tshuva, they decided to publish all of Rav Herzog's stuff, and they call him Maran, I don't know if you can see it, Maran HaGaon, they give him all the titles, but everyone who knows the history knows that it was a very bad relationship between Rav Maimon and Rav Herzog. Okay, thank you very much. See you all next week.